Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson about nursing care in America. But first, Adam, we're going to talk about some research.
Yeah, this is research, Christy, that really affects people all across the United States and probably most of our listeners as well. What do we have, the very first article?
First one's about blood pressure. And one in three American adults has high blood pressure. And if you look at only the people over 55, more than half of American adults have high blood pressure. So this is relevant to everybody.
Yeah, and this article in the American Heart Journal, it's one that I get asked all the time. You know, when I have patients who have high blood pressure, they typically tend to be overweight and frequently don't exercise. And they come back to see me and they say, you know, I've been exercising a lot and that the blood pressure hasn't really gone down very much. And then that gets us into this whole discussion. Well, maybe the blood pressure doesn't respond as much to the exercise as it does to actually losing weight.
Yeah. And I mean, we do know exercise is a very positive thing for your heart health. So we're not saying it's not a good thing to do. But if you're trying to bring your blood pressure down, this study suggests that maybe it's what you weigh and bringing that to an appropriate place is more important than how fit you are.
Yeah. They looked at 35,000 patients in Dallas, Texas, mostly white men. That's where, unfortunately, where a lot of this is done, but over 20 years of time. And when they came to the doctor looking at their blood pressure, their body habitus and their fitness levels, and then saw over time really what happened with these folks whose blood pressures came down. And it really wasn't associated with their physical fitness. That was a good thing, but it really was associated for those that actually lost some weight.
And only the people with normal weight seem to get much of a blood pressure benefit from being more fit. So really, if you have a choice of focusing on your weight or focusing on how fit you are, your weight matters the most, according to the study.
And hopefully, if you're losing weight, you'll be more likely to be able to exercise safely, too. So it's a win-win.
It is.
Speaking of win-win, this next article, Christy, I found disturbing, and I want to see what you think, but it's about – you know, frequently we treat depression as clinicians with drugs and with psychotherapy as a win-win, but it seems like things are changing.
They are. So this was a study in the American Journal of Psychiatry looking to see differences in trends of treatment patterns between people with depression in 1998 versus 2007.
Yeah, and what they really were looking at is, you know, the percentage of people who are treated with combined treatment with drugs and psychotherapy declined over this period of time from 40% to 32%.
And the proportion of people being treated with drugs alone rose from 44% in 98 to 57% in 2007.
Right. It really begins to show that there's a changing nature of the treatment of depression potentially. And I say potentially here, that emphasizing more drugs and less psychotherapy.
Well, here's my take on this, Adam, and you may disagree, but we know that drugs plus psychotherapy is better. But at least in our state, I mean, it's hard to find a therapist. It's hard to get your insurance to pay for the therapist. Then you've got all these copays. And there are barriers to having really good therapy.
Yeah, this integration of mental health care and primary care, which North Carolina is really trying to do and some models of doing it, but it's a far way from happening in the primary care practice.
And I think this more speaks to some of those barriers. And perhaps there are other factors, but I don't know many doctors who really think drugs are the only answer.
No, and unfortunately, I think there's also been a relationship between the direct-to-consumer marketing of prescription drug products, which thinks the pill is the only way to go. But the silver lining here is that the great majority of primary care practitioners do prescribe these drugs. And I suspect they actually do some therapy. But it's probably not really – if you ask the patient, they're probably doing empathy and they're probably listening and they're probably providing some social support. that's probably not getting counted. So maybe it's not quite as bad as they make it sound.
That's a really good point. Okay, let's go to the next one. This is about a different way to screen for colon cancers through something called virtual colonoscopy.
Yeah, you know, occasionally we talk about some research that maybe we don't like because you're going to hear about it and we maybe don't think that it's a good thing. And this was maybe, I don't know if Christy will agree, but this is one of those things where, you know, there was in the news and the Reuters News and the American Journal of X-ray about 2,500 people almost who had this virtual colonoscopy. It's like X-ray scanning of their entire colon, and then they found other things.
They did. So this is less invasive than regular colonoscopy. And so the thought is maybe this would be more attractive to patients. But they really sort of spun it as finding cancers and lesions that were outside of the colon. And in this case, they did in almost half of the patients, including 787 what they call insignificant cancers and 240 more significant findings.
Yeah, and actually not cancers. They found insignificant findings.
And
so
yes.
they don't talk about how many additional cancers they found, which I think was actually probably very, very small because Christy and I see this all the time. We do an X-ray of one party part, and then they comment on six different things. There's cyst in the liver, and there's some blood vessel anomalies in the spleen, and all of which typically doesn't mean anything, but you start doing X-rays on everyone, you're going to start finding things. And I think this actually says, don't do this at this point in time, because I don't think that the technology is sufficiently advanced to guard against all these false positive things that are going to make people worried and not change their lives.
I think it says, let's keep looking for better ways to screen people for colon cancer. But for this one, the jury still needs some time to evaluate. So,
well, this last one, Christy, this last research that matters really is one that I think we can talk about with our great guest in a few minutes here. But talking about really this increasing level of concern about injuries to nurses, those who are perhaps even most vulnerable from patients in U.S. nursing homes.
So this was from data from the 2004 National Nursing Assistant Survey that also linked to facility information. And they found that 34% of nursing assistants who are surveyed reporting having physical injuries from residents, so from the nursing home residents, having aggression towards them in the previous year.
Yeah, and if the nurse was taking overtime or had more patients or was in an Alzheimer's unit, they were much more likely to have these kinds of issues. And this is exactly at least more Alzheimer's unit, more increasing number of all of our loved ones with Alzheimer's. I think this is going to be an increasing serious issue. And I think just like resident work hour reform for our residents to reduce their chances of causing problems, I think reducing overtime here, at least for the nurses, but we don't have enough nurses. What are we going to do?
I know. During this time of nursing shortage, this is a really important question. And
we'll talk about Dr.
Nurses.
Kristen Swanson, who we'll have on our show in just a second.
Okay. So we've had a chance to touch on safety for nursing assistants in nursing homes.
This virtual colonoscopy that I don't like, and Christy's a little more cautiously circumspect.
About mental disorders, treating them with drugs only rather than drugs and psychotherapy.
And certainly reducing weight with blood pressure, but also getting fit.
Absolutely.
And that's going to conclude our Research That Matter portions of our show.
And we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson about nursing care in America. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are really fortunate to be able to have, I think, really one of the more interesting conversations that we've had and we've not had on the show in the last 2 years, which is really not to look at the clinical care that doctors are involved in, which we've done a lot of, but to really look at a whole different aspect, but equally important, which is the role and the care and the needs of nurses in the healthcare system.
And we'd like to welcome Dr. Kristen Swanson, Dean and Alumni Distinguished Professor at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Nursing. prior to coming to UNC in August 2009, Dean Swanson was the University of Washington Medical Center endowed professor in nursing leadership, where she also served as chair of the Family and Child Nursing Department from 2000 to 2009. Her research focuses on caring, responses to miscarriage, and interventions to promote healing after early pregnancy loss. So we are fortunate to have you with us today, Dean Swanson.
Well, I'm honored to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, Dr. Swanson, one of the things that Christy and I always really want to know about is a little bit about how did you get interested in becoming a nurse, doing research, and becoming really a leader nationally in so many of these dialogues?
So why did I become a nurse? I think I was going to be one from the day I was born. I remember my father died when I was young, but my mother told me when I was in college that he had said at one point, don't ever let Kristen be a nurse. And I think, you know, we're all a rebellious one, so I went ahead and became a nurse. And, I think the reason Daddy said that was he saw that the work of nursing, sometimes we did a lot of work that was not the cleanest work in the world, stuff that make people need a nurse to be there during times when they can't care for themselves. And I think my father had concerns about his daughter ever doing that. What I have come out of that is there is no job a nurse does that is not a job that can restore somebody's dignity. In fact, bring the dignity of a nurse up at the same time we're doing it, because we get to help other human beings during their most vulnerable times. It's important work we do.
Nice.
Yeah, that is. That's a neat story. And clearly nurses are, in the front lines for caring for patients. And it sounds like you've really become well known for a new system of caring, or the Swanson theory of caring. And love for you to share that with us and teach us a little bit.
Well, you know, when I was a doctoral student, I was very interested in what it was like for women to miscarry. And at that time, I had seen that we knew very little from the woman's perspective. So, in fact, my dissertation chairperson said to me, if you're going to study miscarriage, then at the same time I want you to ask women what helps them to feel cared for. I was a young woman. I think I was all of 28. And I said, if you want me to do it, sure, I'll do that. Not necessarily my favorite question, but my chair wanted it, you do it. So what ended up happening is I discovered that it was a wonderful way to get at a concept that sometimes is like trying to pin Jell-O against the wall. What does caring mean? And by asking women what helped them to get through it, I ended up understanding that there were about five different ways women wish to be related to. And I've subsequently then studied this in different areas. So quickly, we want to be understood for what we're going through when we're getting care. The next one is, once we're understood, we hope people can be present to our emotions. If I'm angry, I need you to help me calm down. If I'm crying, I need you to soothe me. If I'm joyful, I need you to join me in it. So first, understand me, be emotionally present to me. Do for me what I would do for myself if it were at all possible. The next one is, teach me what I need to know so I can take care of myself. And the last thing is, treat me with the dignity and respect that I deserve, and believe in me that I'm capable of handling what's in front of me.
Wow. Wow, those are that's like a list that almost could be transported at some respects. It has some biblical qualities here,
yeah,
but also some qualities that are universal.
Exactly.
And two things come to mind for me that I want to ask. One is, are those universal principles of caring that apply to more than women? Because I can't imagine that men may not be able to articulate it, but they would want those things.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, this seems like to me almost a definition of a model definition of what a nurse is to me. So I wonder if you can comment on both of those.
Well, I think both of them. And in fact, whenever I present this work to a room full of any providers, whether it's nurses, physicians, anyone, I'll say, I want you to listen to me with two sets of ears. One is the health profession that you are. And then the other one, I want you to think of somebody you care for in your life. It might be your spouse. It might be your child. But if we're really getting at caring, the goal is for you to know your child, be emotionally present to them, do for them what they would do for themselves, teach them what they need to know, and believe in them no matter what. And if we think about that as a way we bring to our professional life or to our personal life, That to me is the – and I do believe that I have gotten at a universal model of caring, which is pretty much what you've asked me.
Well, and this the fact that you were able to really understand this through research, I imagine this was qualitative research done with interviews or focus groups.
In its initial phases, exactly. It was derived through very deep interviews with women who miscarried. The second study I did is I spent an entire year in a newborn intensive care unit interviewing mom, dad, physicians, and nurses about what's it like to care for vulnerable infants. So I asked each one of these people, I thought, whether a parent or a professional, they were responsible for caring for these vulnerable babies. So that was a year of observing, wow, caring in action. And then there was one more study where I interviewed women who had received a long-term public health intervention when their babies were newly born. They'd had a nurse work with them for 18 months from diagnosis of pregnancy to the baby a year old. And I went back and asked those women, what happened with you and that nurse? And it was pushing that even further that I really stretched out and became very clear on this work on caring.
Well, it makes Adam and I are both very involved in teaching family physicians in training. And I'm thinking about how we need to get you to come and work with our residents in training,
actually,
because this really applies to all of us caring for patients, both in maternal and child health, which we do a lot of, but certainly translates over into caring
for chronic disease.
Anyone.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of the fun thing that's happened is since I've developed the original theory, I have now used it in two NIH-funded randomized control trials to see if we consciously work on caring for women who have miscarried, can we make a difference in their healing afterwards, defined as less depression and less faster resolution of depression and grief. The amazing thing was the next study done with couples, so we were looking at both with men. In the presence of a caring counseling session, can you resolve their depression and grief? So I not only have taken this concept of and tried to pin it against the wall and come up with what does caring mean, but then see, can we make it into, if you will, a bit of a prescription and on an experimental design test whether acting this way makes a difference for couples.
Wow.
We've been talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson, Dean and Distinguished Professor of the UNC Chapel Hill School of Nursing. And before we take a break, let me just ask you one other question, which is, let's leapfrog ahead now, a decade, a generation. And where do you see, what is your vision for how this body of research, where is it going to influence us in the next decade of the training of physicians and nurses? What's going to happen?
Magnificent question. I believe that when we get healthcare right, we are going to identify where we can systematize that which we can predictably place, and where do we get the systems lined up so they happen right? And then what do we need about the artistic health provider at the point of care? So you can have all the procedures systematized, prescribed, we know how to do it right, but you still need a person across from you to speak to you, whether it is what in this pamphlet or booklet is right for you. Or as I am doing this very standardized procedure on you, I am taking the time to know, be with, do for, enable, and maintain belief in you. So it's almost, if you will, pulling the art with the science of healthcare. And I believe that we have so much work to do to get the system to be predictable and scientifically safe, but you still need the expert at the point of care to sit across from the person in need.
Well, we need to
so
take a short break.
Articulated.
That's amazing, and it's great. I'm so glad we have another segment with you, because there's so many more things we want to talk about and talk about your role as dean. But we are going to take a short break. We'll return. We're talking with our guest, Dr. Kristen Swanson. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson, Dean of the UNC School of Nursing. And Dean Swanson, we've had a chance to talk a bit about your approach and your research to caring for patients, which is the essence of what we're all trying to do.
Right.
And we certainly need nurses at the forefront along with us caring for patients. And, you know, Adam and I have talked several times on the show about the shortage of nurses in North Carolina and across America. And that's expected to get much worse as our aging population continues to grow. So we're hoping that you have some answers for us.
Well, I have some answers for you, and I have some interesting facts that with the downturn in the economy most recently, we're actually seeing a slight blip where the nursing shortage is not all of what we had heard for the last few years.
It's not as bad.
Not quite as bad this year. Depends on who you're talking about. New graduates are finding it's a difficult time to get a job, but they are getting them. It's just not right away. I would say a bit of the frenzy around the nursing shortage has softened. That said, do not get our eye off the ball because, in fact, the baby boomers are still aging in place. We are moving into a location where we have so many chronic illnesses that need to be managed, and there was a magnificent role for nursing in there. We're finding people still are coming to the hospital sicker than ever. They need the vigilance and the safety of having a nurse watching out for them. So the nursing shortage, it may have reached a temporary halt. Don't take our eye off the ball. It's going to continue to get worse.
You know, it reminds me a little bit about when my father, blessed memory, many years ago when he needed to have an aneurysm repair, and we were down in Atlanta at the time, and we thought about going over to Dallas, where one of the great pioneers of some of the heart surgery was, and having it done there. And we ultimately decided to stay at our hospital in Atlanta, and predominantly because we decided it wasn't the surgery that was going to cause him to have problems. It was actually the nursing care afterwards.
Right.
And we decided that being in a place where the nurses knew him and could care for him and we could interact with him, that caring that you are talking about.
Right.
And I wonder, hearing so much about the stresses on the nursing profession that are out there, and we talked about a research article earlier on the show about the assault on nurses taking care of Alzheimer's patients. Tell us a little bit about the stress on the nursing profession and what are we doing about it as a society?
Well, I believe it's safe to say that, what do we hear, nurses and police are the two people who sit mostly in the most unprotected moments at times because in nursing we are with those patients 24/7 who are hospitalized sometimes because they are having a difficult time controlling their own behavior. So, yes, do nurses get in a position where their safety is threatened? Where do I think the place to deal with that is? It's in the system. Having the hospital set up to own, that it must be responsible for keeping all of its employees as well as all of its patients safe. So where I see great things happening, you mentioned assaults, but there's many other ways that any healthcare provider can get hurt on the job. Whether you're talking needle sticks slipping on a wet floor, very heavy patients. We are now in a place where I believe many more healthcare systems are owning. They have to make a safe work site for healthcare workers. So you see things like now lifts in hospital rooms to help lift patients up so that nurses are not having to have the job of lifting patients as much anymore. We have devices if a patient falls on the floor. There are mechanical devices to help lift a patient up. So we have when patients are out of control, hospitals will now invest money to have somebody in the room to help watch that patient. So it's a much different focus now. It's not just about the nurse keeping his or herself safe. The system has owned it needs to help keep the nurse safe.
Well, thinking about it's not just about the nurse. With the nursing shortage, it seems like, oh, we just need more nurses. Like we should just expand our nursing school and have – that's more about recruitment. And I wonder, in your position as dean, how you see it all playing out. Is it important to just attract and recruit more nurses? Is it about retaining them in North Carolina to provide excellent, safe jobs for them? Is it about opening up more jobs? What's the answer?
The answer is yes, yes, and yes to everything you just said. Is it about bringing more nurses into the system? It's always about bringing more nurses into the system. Then the question is about what education level for the nurse. And my first question back to you then would be, what job are we talking about?
Right.
because one job we may want to talk about nurses coming back into, and I think, in fact, it's gotten very little attention right now, is the deep need for nurse practitioners that's only going to become more so with healthcare reform. We are looking now at how are we going to meet the primary care needs of our nation. You all know as well as I do, family medicine is one enterprise, but so too can nurse practitioners bring to bear there. The other place where we're seeing a deep need for nurse practitioners is inside of acute care settings. For safety reasons, there have been laws set now about the number of hours a resident can work. Patients still need 24/7 vigilance on medical care. There is now becoming expanded roles for nurse practitioners to also be working as acute care practitioners in the hospital. So the way I see it is the shortage. We know about RNs. We're beginning to hear about nurse practitioners, and we also hear about the shortage of faculty. It's the shortage of faculty sometimes that puts the limits on the number of excellent students who have applied but cannot come into the schools because there's not enough teachers for them. So we can build capacity to meet the shortage in the future, but we can't just open up the floodgates and suddenly teach everyone today.
And with the different and evolving roles of nurses, there's so much of this team-based care that we're promoting, certainly in primary care and in specialty care. We talked about it with the cancer center as well. And we need well-trained nurses who are able to counsel patients, who are able to be a part of that team-based approach. And that's a different type of training than perhaps may have been done. I don't know. Was that different than
what we did
30 years ago?
I don't know that I would say it's a different type of education. I would say it's a different type of awareness about the roles that a nurse can fill. You know, there's some beautiful work done at Children's Hospital in Seattle recently where they looked at the level of disclosure of bad news to a patient from a physician. It is more fully disclosed when there is a nurse present. So why might that be? My thought is the delivery of difficult news is hard for anyone, and that capacity to deliver the news in a fully informative way, but to be able at the same time you're articulating the difficult words about what I have to say about you to watch how the patient is responding. The nurse in the room can watch the patient and say back to the physician, you know, could you go back and say one more about this? And when the physician leaves the room, the nurse can sit with the family and talk about it one more. Well, to my mind, that's what team care is.
Yes.
It's that wraparound of the person-centeredness of it and yet making sure the right information is given. Recent study done on telehealth out of Florida. The families were asked, if you compare the care you receive on telehealth, another group of families received the care on in person. The families that received it during telehealth said that it was actually more family-centered care than the in-person care with a specialist. What was the difference? Turns out the telehealth, the specialist was on the screen. Patient out in the rural area was brought to rural clinic, saw a specialist on the screen. Specialist did their work, physician specialist, screen went off, but there was always a nurse there sitting with the family to say afterwards, okay, when the doctor said this, did you get what he was saying? Well, let's talk about what she meant.
Wow.
So there was an automatic debriefer.
Wow, that's impressive. We're talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson, Dean of the UNC School of Nursing, and we're going to need to wrap up in a second, but let me ask you one last question, because your body of research that we discussed earlier about caring and the theory of how we do this for patients, combined with some of the information you've just been describing about the complexities and the changing roles and the increasing roles and the integration of nurses, but also suggest some stress on nurses to do a lot more, perhaps with not more resources, suggests that there needs to be care for those nurses themselves. How do you teach and provide, what do we know for nurses themselves for the caring of their own mental health that's important to prevent burnout, to prevent drug abuse and prescription and all the other kinds of things that physicians we know are quite subject to?
Well, nurses are equally subject to. And I think it begins with, several layers. The first one, taking the theory of caring and turning it back on yourself. What does it do to take to understand what you're going through, to be emotionally present to the work that you do? What can you do for yourself? What more might you need to learn to be able to handle that situation better in the future? And in the end, how do you continue to bring a hopeful attitude to the work that you get to do every single day? So you do that for yourself. We stand back as a group of nurses, and we do that for each other. We stand back as a profession, and we start to ask the questions about what does it take to care for ourselves? So there's got to be many layers. And when I say we as a profession ask the questions, we make that the work of important nursing research. How do we keep the best in our profession to keep giving in the way we expect them to?
And is that type of professional development through some self-reflection and using support from your colleagues, is that something you're teaching as a critical part of the nursing training?
As part of our nursing education, mm-hmm. we most certainly are. And whenever I go and speak anywhere in the country about the application of my work on caring, I always ask to meet with the leadership group in the hospital that I'm talking with and begin to ask them to think about what does that mean if we take it upon ourselves to care for our own? What types of leadership, what types of management practices do we need in place? So you work with the individual nurse, but you also work with the system. And by the way, I never limit it to just how do we care for the nurses. It's how do we care for all people in healthcare. What does it take to keep
fantastic.
Us there?
That's wonderful. We really can't thank you enough for not only sharing your expertise, but also your sense of caring for the people of UNC Healthcare, people of North Carolina, and as you've so eloquently stated, the people of the United States of America. We've been talking with Dr. Kristen Swanson, Dean of the UNC School of Nursing. Thank you very much for being our guest.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you, Dean Swanson.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and experiences.
We want you to write us with your own questions and experiences, and we will address these on an upcoming show. You can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081 and leave us a message. And we'd like to ask our producer, Julie Steiner, to read us our very first House Call today.
Recently, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I'm writing because I was pretty horrified that the diagnosis was given to me over the phone by a nurse. After waiting for 5 days, I received a call. And while the nurse was kind, I was alone before and after the call. I was scared, and as expected, I started crying right after the diagnosis. Is this really the way a cancer diagnosis is supposed to be given to a patient? Why isn't this type of thing done with a patient in the doctor's office? Thanks for your thoughts.
Wow. I guess first I'd say is I'm so sorry that happened, and one, that you have the breast cancer, but that you had to receive the information in a way that really wasn't the right thing for you.
Yeah, you know, Christy, this got me thinking a little bit when I saw this, and I thought, you know, is this a common occurrence? And I think it probably varies some, but I did check in a couple different hospitals, and it turns out, at least as far as, for instance, breast cancer, that is how many hospitals will do that initially, because a biopsy is done and they may get a result back within a day or two or three, and they'll frequently call the patient to let them know and have a short 10 or 15 minute conversation and then schedule at that point in time, and it is usually done with one of the nurses who works and provides, you know, very knowledgeable and empathetic nurse, but it's different. And I just thought, you know, boy, and when, like, for melanoma, I was talking with the provider who says, no, for every time I have a melanoma diagnosis, if it's a serious melanoma, I bring the patient in. I don't do it that way.
Well, that's certainly what we learn in medical school, is that it's best to do it face-to-face in the office. And so it does raise some questions about, is it that we can't make those appointments? Is that
I asked one of the nurses in charge about this particular situation, and she said, well, we offer the patients a choice that they can come back in or we can call them, and almost always the patients say, you know, give us a call. But I think that's really difficult. It's like saying, I'd like a call that it's not cancer.
Right.
You know, but once it is cancer, you know, you never think it's going to be you, I think. So I think that perhaps the protocols should change some because I think people have a hard time really thinking about, well, what would I really want if it is cancer? And then once it is cancer, is that really what I wanted?
Right. Okay, Julie, what do we have next?
My wife recently started feeling dizzy. Since it was Sunday, she went to an urgent care and they told her that she has vertigo. They gave her a medicine called meclizine, and this did seem to help the dizziness, but it also made her sleep for several hours. The episode seemed to get better after 5 days. A friend of mine said that when she had something similar, her doctor recommended that she do some exercises to avoid taking this medication. Why didn't our doctor recommend such medicines to us?
Well, that's, again, a really good question. Thank you for sharing. Vertigo is such a tough thing because usually in a case, what like sounds like with your wife, it's from a benign cause, sometimes something called BPPV or a labyrinthitis or an inflammation of the inner ear. And it usually goes away. But in the meantime, it can make you feel awful. The room is spinning and some people vomit and can't eat. It can make you feel terrible. And it's also scary.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly making sure that you're not having a stroke or something more serious, which can be concerning. But if you've ruled those things out, you really come down to most commonly kind of a inner ear vertigo that's due to maybe a virus in this inner ear that may be due to positional changes where you get break off a little small microscopic calcium particles that can kind of get stuck in the middle ear. And these exercises that I presume the doctor prescribed for your friend are ones designed to dislodge those particles and have them move away. And they're pretty simple and safe exercises to do with very little drawback, but maybe not all physicians know about them.
Yeah, I would say they're more commonly used in an ENT's office. And the medicine, the meclizine medicine, also called Antivert, does help to take some of the symptoms away, although it does make you really tired.
And it helps out with you, particularly if you had the nausea, it can be really helpful.
Mm-hmm,
those exercises, just in case you want to look them up, are called EPLEY, the most common ones, E-P-L-E-Y. And there's home EPLEY exercises that you can look up and read about them on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Julie, what's next?
I am 55 years old and have swelling of my eyelids. They do not itch, but they do crust some. My primary care doctor told me it was likely allergies, and I started Zyrtec, but it didn't help. I went to a specialist who indicated it was a condition called blepharitis and that it was going to be a chronic problem. What can you tell me about this?
Well, again, a really good question, and thank you for writing about that, because blepharitis actually has some connection with allergies sometimes, and I could easily see how initially that would be a reasonable treatment to try to cut down on if allergies were causing the swelling. But it sounded like your case, it was something a little more than that.
And so just to answer the question of what is blepharitis, it is a pretty common eyelid problem that is inflammation of that eyelid. It sometimes is related to having an infection. It could be a bacterial eye infection or symptoms with dry eyes. And also can be related to other things going on, like having acne rosacea.
Yeah, and it does happen more commonly as we get older. And then a lot of people, kind of like dandruff, it tends to be there for a long time. It can be kind of chronic, but it can be controlled. And one of the things people don't think of enough, perhaps, is just simple measures that they can do at home to help control it, rather than perhaps taking antibiotics or using antibiotic creams, which could be useful in some circumstances.
So using a warm compress, like a warm washcloth applied to the outside of your eyelids can be helpful.
And some gentle cleansing solutions, sometimes dilute Johnson's & Johnson's baby shampoo with water and a Q-tip and cleansing off the eyelid surfaces and then rinsing your eyes. So just some real simple things that can be done and hopefully help.
Okay.
What's
our last one?
I am 65 years old and have hoarseness all the time. I saw an ENT doctor who said I had swelling of my larynx and that it came from reflux of acid. I do take ibuprofen for arthritis, and he said to stop that and to take Nexium. Is there anything else I can do, and how long do I need to take the medicine? I still cough and clear my throat all the time.
Well, we're going to answer this really quickly because we don't have a lot of time, but the answer is yes, there's some other things you can do.
Reflux can present in this way with hoarseness. Resting your voice and doing the routine things you would do for acid reflux, like eating smaller meals and sitting upright afterwards, might make a difference.
Not eating before you go to bed. And it's not always the same symptoms of reflux that normally happen to other people that are causing this. But really, voice retraining, you need to maybe rest your voice. Maybe see even a voice therapist specialist that you aren't coughing and clearing your throat, because that's going to aggravate it.
We've had a chance to talk today about blepharitis, or swelling of the eyelids. We've talked about hoarseness and reflux. We've talked about delivering breast cancer information over the phone.
And a little bit about getting dizzy and what you can do with some Epley exercises.
So thank you for joining us today on Your Health. We hope that we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you, and we want you to write us. Send your questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Call us at 919-966-8081. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Kristen Swanson. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We will look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.